Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Dr. John Endres. Well, let's get into our news stories of today. The first one we're going to be talking about is lawlessness and housing, which don't seem like they necessarily go together, but in this case, in these two stories, they do. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the relatively small story, but still, I think one that's very illustrative of where the country is at the moment. This is reported by News24. For the past 2 weeks, Cecilia Tebe has slept on a thin blanket in Randgate Boxing Club, a hall on the floor, along with 300 other people. These were people who lived in a squatter camp, and they were effectively forced out of the area by violence and intimidation from illegal miners known as, usually referred to as Zama-Zamas. The residents of Soprong in Ward 2 were moved to the hall in Ward 4 by their councillor, who appears to have just sort of, I'm not sure what under what process this was done, because councillors don't actually have the authority to do this. But anyway, he moved these people into the boxing hall in a neighboring ward without telling that ward councillor. Because according to the media reporting here, these people were being subjected to absolute horrific abuse by these gangs of Zama Zamas. They had appealed to the police and got no answer, so they appealed to their ward councillor, who managed to move them. The interviewers said that they heard stories of women being dragged out of hiding places and beaten by the Zama Zamas, threatened to kidnap their children, remove limbs unless they handed over cash and electronics. And the residents said that every night at around sort of 10, the sound of gunshots would announce the arrival of Zama Zama gangs, who would then proceed to harass and loot people in this area. This woman, who has now been effectively turned into a sort of internally displaced person or a refugee. From one suburb to another. So we're not talking about from one end of the country to the other, but still not great. Was living in this informal settlement after she and others said they were promised a home in the Montrose mega city project in Randfontein, which government had intended to build 13,000 houses. But the project, after a year, basically came to a halt. It was launched by Gauteng Premier David Makhura and Paul Mashatile, and it was supposed to have all sorts of houses for military veterans. It was supposed to have bond houses built by people themselves. It was supposed to have RDP houses built by the government. It was supposed to have renting things, a college, a private hospital, a regional hospital, but the project just stalled, and now all of the buildings are just sort of left to rot there, being slowly looted for resources. So that's the first story. At the same time, Daily Maverick had some reporting on Johannesburg's 188 hijacked buildings, most of which are in the city centre, but many are not. And the mayor of Johannesburg claimed that there were over 10 court orders the city had gotten to evict people, but they only provided evidence to the media of seven. It was revealed that they had only appeared to have enacted one of those evictions. The main obstacle here being that people apparently cannot be moved without alternative accommodation due to the PIE Act. So, John, similar thing in both these stories: lawlessness, people breaking rules, people just kind of running amok, the police nowhere to be found, and also people desperate for housing. What do you make of these stories?
Yeah, I think what we see with these stories is how the state effectively abdicating its primary duty, which is to safeguard the life, property, and liberty of citizens, leads to an escalating horror show of, one bad thing happening on top of another. And that's, I think, common to both of these stories. We also see that the people most affected by this abdication of responsibility by the state are the poor, because they are left defenseless. So in the case of the Zama Zamas, those guys rock up with guns or clubs or whatever they have and a willingness to use them. If you're an ordinary person staying in an informal settlement, there's not that much you can do to stop them. You could call the police, but of course, in South Africa, we know that that doesn't usually help very much. And so it leads to situations like this one, where these 250, 300 people have now been forced to move out of their homes in the informal settlement and into a boxing hall where they, you know, have to sleep on the ground altogether, which isn't great for them. It's also not good for the people whose boxing hall it is. So you get this escalation of consequences.
You know, one public bathroom with a couple of toilets being shared between 300 people. Apparently, everyone in that community hall, according to the reporting, is doing a lot of work together to keep it all clean. How much stress it is on everyone involved.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is also that it's the, once again, the vulnerable people who are the most affected because they don't have the resources to do much about it. And I think what it also illustrates is the fact that in a country like South Africa, with all the potential it has, if you don't get the economy growing, people are not going to be placed in a position where they can take charge of their own lives and find alternative solutions to whatever problems they face. If you're living in the informal settlement, I think the article also mentions that most people living there rely on 350 rand SRD grants or child grants if they've got children for income. You know, you haven't got options. You haven't got options in your life. And that is also why economic growth is so important, why we keep harping on about it at the IRR. It is what puts people in a position to take control of their own lives and to be able to make decisions and to have alternatives. And that is ultimately what needs to happen in South Africa. It is currently not happening. And what is also very distinctive about the situation, I find, is that the government, or let's say the ANC, pays so much lip service to saying that they care about the people, they care about the poor, they keep reiterating this, that they want to help poor people, and yet their way of running the country and their policies are causing these kinds of consequences. And I think the utter hypocrisy and shamelessness of the ANC is really put on display by stories like this.
And, you know, in our pre-show discussion, we were just talking about how we've got these sort of supposedly merciful laws that are supposed to help poor people, like the Pi Act, which basically says that you can't evict people unless there's some actual alternative place for them to go. But, you know, you have that as a policy which tends to be largely unworkable because it just creates sort of essentially nasty criminal-controlled slums like this. But also you've got bad implementation on top of that, right? You've got the fact that the government, when it was asked why these hijacked buildings, why people hadn't been moved out, well, you know, it's because we don't have the money to move them to a new place. Considering how much misspend there is in government, I'm pretty sure that you could find that money if you spent it perhaps less on inflated IT contracts or whatever the government is always throwing its money away on. So we've got bad policy badly implemented. And as you say, it's the people at the bottom of the chain who really get screwed over the worst by this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and there's another aspect to this, which is the destruction of economic value. You know, so even if there's not active bombing of a city, you know, of destruction of physical infrastructure, neglect and the inability to protect it and leaving it open to criminal elements to take over infrastructure like buildings in this case does destroy their value and just as effectively as a bombing would. And that is what is happening here. So if you read that story about the 188 hijacked buildings in the CBD, I think that's only the CBD actually, and the, you know, all over the city, there's hundreds, thousands more buildings where that's the case.
Yeah, I don't think there is an accurate count of the houses outside of the CBD, or the buildings outside of the CBD, because sometimes it's even just random suburban houses you'll be fined or hijacked. I think we did a story last year where a large house in Bryanston was taken over essentially, and the whole thing just completely turned into, like, I think the sort of 4 or 5 bedroom house had literally like 100 people squashed into it.
And that's actually not too far from where I am here. As it happens, just today on the councillors WhatsApp group, there've been raids today in this area on hijacked houses. And yeah, it's not limited to the CBD. It's everywhere throughout Gauteng, throughout Johannesburg, probably throughout the country. Maybe no, probably in the Western Cape as well.
Yeah, it's a recurring problem of just what happens when you have poor lacking property rights. I mean, I remember hearing a story from a woman who lived in an RDP house, or she used to live in an RDP house in Soweto, who was because the government hadn't provided her with some kind of title deed, and because the police didn't really have much of an interest in helping her, her daughter, who I think had taken up with a really bad news guy, I think she was into drugs, she threw this woman out of her house that she lived in, and she could get no help from the state to rectify this. So she had to live in a shack. Property rights are not just for the rich.
But is this going to change, right? I think that's also something we mentioned in our pre-show discussion. We're not really seeing any attempts, I think, by any actors, political actors, to say, well, this whole property rights system needs a shake up. It's fundamentally broken in a way that it doesn't allow for value to be generated, for assets to be maintained, for private property rights to be asserted, for improvements to be made. The current setup that we've got in terms of enforcement and policy inevitably leads to this outcome of value destruction, degrading infrastructure, and things falling apart. And it's going to continue as long as the rules are like this.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is about a feud that broke out in the DA. Now, there's a number of, this has sort of been going on since last year. I think we actually very briefly talked about it. It started with a report that Minister of the Environment and Fisheries and Forestry, Dion George, was on the verge of being fired by DA leader John Steenhuisen for a variety of things. There was apparently complaints from some of his staff. There was also claims that he had sort of broken with party policy on this or that, or not been working well with cabinet, etc. And this kicked off a feud that went on through basically the whole of December. Dion George then went out to say essentially that John Steenhuisen was trying to get rid of him. And because he was captured by the ANC, speaking to in an interview on ENCA, he said Steenhuisen's personal financial vulnerability leaves the DA with a leader who cannot challenge the ANC and the GNU, who's willing to throw countless loyal, hardworking DA leaders like me to the wolves when they stand up for DA members and SA's interests, who cannot exit the GNU under any circumstances, given he is completely financially compromised. He also claimed that Steenhuisen had lost control, had lost his use of the DA's credit card as leader because he had overspent on it. And basically, it all got very messy. His allies, Dion George's allies in the media, mostly from the animal rights activists, claimed that he had been thrown out because he had opposed. Because he had promoted bans on so-called canned lion hunting and had been too pro-animal. The DA hit back with all sorts of things. When Dion George resigned from the DA recently, Helen Ziller issued a note saying, Democratic Alliance notes the resignation of Dion George from the party. It's unfortunate that Dr. George has resigned before answering pending disciplinary before the DA's Federal Legal Commission allegations, including that staff appointments were done in a way that unjustifiably raised their salaries at public expense, allegations that his staff in his ministry sought departmental information to pursue internal political party matters, bringing the party into disrepute in the media. It would have been preferable for Dr. George to go through the Federal Legal Commission process to test the veracity of these allegations. The rest of the FLC processes will be determined by the DA's federal executive on Monday. We wish Dr. George well in his future endeavors. That was a statement from Helen Ziller. One anonymous DA source told the media, one of them had to go. There was growing anger amongst activists on the ground, the story says. Quote, we are set to win 60 municipalities, and this nonsense between two drama queens is hurting us. People on the ground are furious. One of them had to go, and everyone knows which side the leadership is on. John's. There's also been some pushback, and we published an opinion piece from Trevor Ortel, who's involved with the sort of hunting groups and wildlife conservation, about Dion George's policies, that they were effectively unreasonably hostile towards sustainable hunting practices in South Africa, and that this was going to hurt the rural economy. John, what do you make of all this? I think there's a number of things here. Firstly, I think that George's policies were bad and that we should have the promotion of sustainable hunting in this country. I don't really see what's wrong with breeding a lion to be shot. It's the same as breeding a cow to be turned into a steak. People just feel more sentimental about it because a lion is a majestic and beautiful animal, whereas a cow is not so much. But as for this personal stuff, it's been quite vicious. And I thought that that was my first comment on the story when it first came out, is that this was very, there was no going back from the very first leak because of how personal and aggressive some of this stuff was. What do you make of this whole story?
And I think one take is that it's a leadership spat in a political party is, you know, that happens every single day. It's not that unusual. In this case, I think it was pretty, it escalated to quite a large extent and probably did have to end with one of the two leaving. And I think certainly that John Steenhuisen has a much stronger base within the DA than Dion George has. And so John Steenhuisen was ultimately able to decide this battle in his own favor when Dion George resigned. But one aspect that is maybe important, and I keep coming back to this, is the question of economic growth. And, you know, it was Dion George supportive promoting policies that make the economy grow. And there I have my doubts. You know, so one example would be what you just mentioned with sustainable wildlife management. I think, was on the side of the environmentalists who maybe are not always thinking about how to generate economic value out of wildlife, which helps to protect that wildlife, you know, and helps to sustain populations of animals that would otherwise be endangered. So I think that was not an economically sound policy on his part. Then I'm also thinking of a comment I heard from the forestry industry, which was trying to get a meeting with him and unable to do so for a very long time. So he apparently would not speak to them. And I also think of the Climate Change Act regulations, which were published, I think, by Dion George's ministry and really cast a complex web of interlocking regulations over private industry, imposing very high reporting requirements on companies that in South Africa are already struggling and would definitely have a suppressing effect on economic growth. And so, you know, my preference would be for us to have an environment minister who realizes the importance of the economy and is able to formulate and promote policies that will make the economy grow. And I hope that Dion George's successor will be such an environment minister.
I think one of the larger issues here is I think there's personal beef and decisions and relationships and things that also have to do with this. So I don't know if Dion George's appointment in the first place as minister was a particularly good decision. But that being said, I think that what's going on here is also a sort of larger issue that largely I think goes unexamined about the DA. This organization I have quite a lot of familiarity with. I was a public representative of it. My family's been involved with it forever. My father still is. It's actually a very diverse organization within it, sort of ideologically and culturally and whatever way you want to split it, right? It has members who live in shacks and townships. It has members who live in fancy pants houses in Westcliff, in Johannesburg. It's kind of got, and everything in between, right? You've got, ideologically speaking, you've got people who are sort of what you might call woke left. You've also got people who are basically sort of MAGA-ish, kind of, if they were Americans, they would be kind of Trumpists. You've got people who are deeply religious. You've got people who are sort of quite fiercely militantly atheist. And you've also got, of course, centrist liberals sort of in the middle of the whole thing, kind of being pushed and pulled by both sides. So there's sort of some incoherence in the party. You can kind of see that in this opinion piece on the Daily Friend by Trevor Wattel, where at its internal party conference, the DA passes two resolutions. One basically says that canned lion hunting is evil and shouldn't be promoted, but also we need to do sustainable hunting and things in a separate resolution, right? So we have these sort of almost diametrically opposed policy positions adopted by the party kind of at the same time. And I think this continues to be a bit of a risk for the DA, that one that makes it quite a difficult organization to manage, is it has this enormous difference within it. And it's kept together by opposition to the ANC, by belief in you know, its successes in government in certain places. What's your take on that analysis? Do you agree? And if so, what do you think needs to be done to make sure that the whole thing doesn't split apart like a, you know, it's sausage put in the microwave?
So probably the best way to ensure ideological coherence and consistency in a party is to make sure that it consists of one person only. But as soon as you have multi-person parties, you are going to have inconsistencies. And I think the more people are involved, the more complicated it gets. So we've seen some recent polling results, I think, from the Social Research Foundation that put the DA at 32% to the ANC's 35%. And there you're getting into this big tent kind of territory, you know, where to reach those sorts of numbers, you are going to attract people who have very different views of how the world works and how it should work. So that's kind of unavoidable. You know, as the party gets larger, I think it's the views of its members are going to become more diverse. The response it takes, I think, is active leadership. You know, so the leader of the party needs to develop a coherent vision that is appealing enough to enough members of the party to draw them along and to make them work together despite their differences. And I'm not sure that any party at the moment is doing that well enough in South Africa. I think opposition to another party is actually not enough of a vision. I think that competent governance is not enough of a vision. You do need more than that. And that is, I think, currently a failing of our party political system, that the political parties are not very good at drawing out this vision of where they want to take the country in a way that binds together the members of the party. Possibly the EFF is best at doing that, but I'm not sure that the other parties are very good at it.
I think the DA has tried at several points, but I don't think it's succeeded in those attempts. And I agree that the EFF is at least a party that, while it does benefit in its internal coherence a bit from the fact that it is effectively a cult of personality, it does also focus a lot on sort of ideologically getting everyone on the same page. When there's a fight in the EFF, it's not because they're disputing or, you know, whether to nationalize something. They all agree on that. It's just who should be in charge of said nationalization. It's the only thing they seem to fight about. And the answer always ends up being Julius Malema. It is a difficult thing to manage. And as you say, this is also a thing that happens to parties as they grow. I think it was famously said, I think by Tony Leon, that the DA was much easier to manage when they could have a caucus meeting in a lift.
Exactly. It's absolutely true.
Which is not the case anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to our last story. And this is about a disaster that seems to be unfolding across South Africa's livestock industry relating to a big outbreak of foot and mouth disease, the horrible disease that affects many, I think, hooved animals. I'm sure farmers may correct me if I get any of those details wrong, but basically it kills young animals and it leaves the adults with these horrible, painful lesions, which sometimes are so awful that the animals need to be euthanized. The farmers who have been affected say that they're not particularly happy with the way that government has responded. Originally, they tried to sort of control this disease, as I understand it, by quarantining it when there was an outbreak of it, but that seems to have failed. There are no cattle. There's been very little control. Reporting by the Common Sense said that, according to a government report published in 2022 already, that there was a total breakdown in the sort of biosecurity system in South Africa, and that government had essentially failed to keep proper control over livestock. That's now caused this disease to spread all over the country, even to places where it previously hasn't been. I think it was mostly in the past confined to places like Limpopo, but now it's everywhere, even in places like KZN, Gauteng. There is a vaccine for the disease. Agriculture Minister John Steenhuisen has said that The government has a 10-year plan to try and vaccinate as many animals as they can. There are some issues, though. Firstly, this vaccine only is effective, apparently, for, I think it's 3 months, which means that you have to constantly sort of roll it out over and over again. And some farmers have criticized this, saying that, well, government's just not, as with most things the South African government does, it's just not that effective at doing it. And we should be looking more to the private sector, which is currently not allowed. You have to get your vaccine for your animals from the state. John, what's your take on all this?
Well, I'll start by talking about the Golden Gate Bridge. And there was a post on social media recently by somebody who said that, you know, only when he was a bit older did he realize how much work it is to keep stuff going, even once you've got it. And the example is the Golden Gate Bridge, because, you know, imagine that you're the city, you've just built it, it's beautiful. On day one, you've got to start with maintenance effectively. And Golden Gate Bridge currently is continuously maintained. Like every single day, there's work crews sort of spraying the salt water off, removing rust, repainting it, and it's ongoing. And if you don't do that, then it's going to fall apart. And that's what's happening in so many different areas of life in South Africa, including cattle, for example. This is where this foot and mouth disease problem comes from. The article that you referred to on the Common Sense, I think, was very illustrative, because it mentions a government report from the year 2022 that already said, you know, we've got a real problem on our hands, and identified every single component of keeping foot and mouth disease at bay failing. And that ranges sort of from the movement of animals, you know, so you've got to control the movement of animals, because if they circulate freely, the disease can be transmitted. You know, it's transmitted by viruses, and then, you know, it spreads throughout the country. It's the surveillance and monitoring. You know, so if you test for the disease, the results are meant to come back in 36 hours so the farmer can do something about it. But the results are only coming back in 30 days. Production of vaccines is falling apart. Veterinarians are not available. So every single component of the system, fences are rusting, falling apart. And that's where the problem comes from. And I think that links it back to the other stories that we did with the hijacked buildings and the Zama-Zamas. If you as the state stop paying attention, you stop doing your job, you stop the maintenance, you stop enforcing law and order, you get disasters all over the place. And they just multiply and multiply. Nick?
And, you know, this capacity problem is not necessarily, I think, that easy to turn around, at least not at the speed that needs to be done to get this under control. So it seems to me that, you know, opening up the doors to allow the private sector to do what it can is the best short-term solution, at least. You know, normally I'm in favor of that, but I think even if you're not a market kind of person, you can probably see that in this specific instance, there is a lot of reason to say, well, let's at least let people get their own vaccines and, you know, break free of the state, because otherwise, you know, our cattle industry is going to be threatened. And I mean, this is a big thing in South Africa. This is a big part of our farming. We have a huge cattle industry, and we have every type of cattle farmer you can imagine, from very poor to very rich. A huge outbreak of foot and mouth will be devastating for many very, you know, poor and struggling rural communities already.
And another observation here, Nick, is that, you know, the longer you wait before you start doing something about it, the more work it is to turn the situation around. And our government has now waited for many, many years to do anything about this, and it's gotten worse and worse. And, you know, if we start doing something now, the agriculture minister says 10 years. Like, imagine if you're a farmer, you know, you're losing money today. You know, your animals are being culled. You can't sell your product. You are incurring costs to try to contain the disease. And here's somebody telling you, you know, just give it 10 years. By then, you know, we should have a plan to get things working. I'm not very happy with that. I think that's very unambitious and much too slow.
Indeed. But with that, we shall call today's episode to a close. We will not have an episode on Friday. So just be aware of that if you're looking for us on Friday. But we will have one next Friday after that. And we're also going to be doing some new things, I think, with the Daily Friend show this year, which may be of interest to our viewers, but I'll leave that for when we actually do them. Thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found the show interesting, and we'll see you all tomorrow on the Daily Friend show. Cheers, everyone. The Daily Friend show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.